Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Polling started early in eastern Ukraine as separatists vote on independence and an attack by militants in Afghanistan. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Eastern Ukrainians began voting early today in a referendum on secession, with most voters saying they were voting for a break because of the recent military campaign by Kiev against pro-Russian separatists. The polling was brisk at stations in Donetsk and Luhansk abutting Russia, but claims quickly mounted of multiple voting and pro-unity activist posted a video showing how easy it was. That is the voice of Roman Lyagin, the head of the Separatist Election Commission, who told VOA that multiple voting was impossible because people had to queue for more than half an hour to vote. Therefore, no other precautions were necessary. They have not, as it happens, organized the clear controls over the ballots or the voter lists, which are being widely criticized in Kiev and Western capitals. Interim Ukrainian President Oleksandr Turchynov warned secession supporters that independence is a step into the abyss and is appealing to the rebels to join talks. Rallying outside the Chinese embassy in Vietnam's capital today are protesters against China's deployment of an oil rig in the disputed South China Seas near the Paracel Islands. Marianne Brown reports.
Hundreds of people across Vietnam took part in anti-China demonstrations Sunday to protest China's deployment of an oil rig near the Paracel Islands, which both countries claim. In a highly unusual move, the protests were covered in state-run media. Such protests are usually strictly controlled by police, and participants are often prevented from attending. In Hanoi, around 500 people gathered in a park opposite the Chinese embassy, the biggest anti-China protest to take place here for many years. Beijing claims nearly all of the South China Sea, which contains key shipping lanes and is believed to be rich in oil and gas deposits. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
Police in Yemen say a suicide bomber detonated an explosive-laden vehicle, killing at least 12 officers outside a police building in the country's south. Several civilians were also injured in the blast in the Hadhramout province capital. Meanwhile, in Sana'a, the Interior Ministry says three gunmen were killed attempting an attack on a presidential guard checkpoint. The two attacks appear to be a reprisal for an army operation to drive al-Qaeda out of southern provinces. Authorities say at least four people were killed and seven wounded when a suicide bomber blew himself up in a soccer stadium in northwest Pakistan. Police officials say the bombing today was targeting refugees from the nearby Khyber tribal region as they registered with the government after fleeing their own communities and villages. Authorities say a suicide bombing in southern Afghanistan killed at least five people and wounded about 40 others, including soldiers. Ayaz Ghul has more from Islamabad that violence is continuing as the Afghan presidential election campaign rolls on.
The deadly attack occurred in Kandahar province, one of the violence-hit southern Afghan regions where Taliban insurgents routinely carry out such attacks. An Afghan army vehicle was said to be the target of the suicide bombing, in which mostly civilians were killed or wounded. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. Meanwhile, former Foreign Minister Zalmay Rasool, who finished third in the April 5th election, endorsed Afghan presidential frontrunner Abdullah Abdullah, a boost to his presidential campaign before a runoff election scheduled for mid-June. Speaking together in Kabul, Rasool said national unity, stability, peace and prosperity formed basis of his decision to back Abdullah because Afghans are tired of war and discrimination. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
There is growing international condemnation of the Boko Haram Islamist militant group over its abduction of more than 300 Nigerian schoolgirls. The top religious leader in the birthplace of Islam said Boko Haram has been set up to smear the image of Islam. In an unusual move this weekend, the wife of U.S. President Barack Obama delivered the president's weekly address to talk about the young women's abduction.
This unconscionable act was committed by a terrorist group determined to keep these girls from getting an education. Grown men attempting to snuff out the aspirations of young girls.
Meanwhile, some of the Nigerian schoolgirls who managed to escape are speaking out, trying to bring attention, along with the parents of the girls still missing, to the plight that continues as hundreds of their schoolmates are missing. Boko Haram's leader said the group will sell the girls. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News, Washington.
Good evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
Just in a mindset, under DPP, everything was possible. The sky was not the limit. The limit was your own mind.
As Malawians prepare for elections, we profile the top four presidential candidates.
En termes de chiffres, le café se porte mal, se porte même très mal.
Our coffee is currently in very bad shape. That's the lowest figure we have known since Cameroon started growing coffee in 1957.
Despair for Cameroon's coffee farmers as they blame government policies.
It is our Aisha Lorien. I come in perfect love and perfect trust.
And we look at paganism in South Africa. And those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
With only a few days remaining until the May 20th presidential elections, candidates in Malawi are leaving no stone unturned in trying to woo people to vote for them. Lamek Masina in Blantyre profiles the top four presidential candidates and their parties and what they promise to do if elected.
Among 12 people vying for Malawi's highest office, four main candidates stand out. They are Lazarus Chakwera of the opposition Malawi Congress Party, Atupele Muluzi of the United Democratic Front, Peter Mutharika of the Democratic Progressive Party, and President Joyce Banda of the Ruling People's Party. All the four major parties have ruled the country before. This is reflected in their one of their campaign messages, which hinge on the same topic, poverty alleviation through improved agricultural policies and job creation. Each of these candidates is a stranger to the presidential race, except President Joyce Banda, who in the 2009 elections was a running mate to then-President Bingwa Mutharika until she formed her own party after a fallout with him. In her campaign messages, President Banda is promising Malawians continued anti-poverty effort, which she says has been pursuing since she took office in April 2012 following the death of Mr. Mutharika. Despite a corruption scandal in which her office is directly implicated, President Banda's administration has managed to avoid serious problems except for what she says he inherited from the previous government. These include fuel and foreign exchange shortages and a high inflation rate. President Banda says she's ready for any election outcome. She says God will decide whether she should continue in the office, but she says if Malawians do not vote her back in, she will honorably leave. Atubele Muluzi, the son of the former president and founder of the opposition UDF, Bakili Muluzi, who ruled the country from 1994 to 2004. Probably the youngest presidential candidate ever in Malawi, the 35-year-old Muluzi is most popular among youth who constitute more than half of the country's population. Muluzi promises Malawians a change in leadership style. He says his government will introduce clean politics devoid of mudslinging and self-enrichment. He says have soiled the country's political landscape since independence 50 years ago. 74-year-old Peter Mutharika is hoping that voters remember the previous achievements of his party and his elder brother, the late Bingwa Mutharika.
As 8 years, Pamet Nine Bomber, Zikolonas Nakwambi, Mugramiso Gunokulongwe, Sanjepot.
He says we constructed a lot of roads in the capital, Lilongwe. We constructed the Sanje port, we built Kalonga Chitipa Road, and in addition to that, we changed the mindset. He says we are ready to lead the country again. The 59-year-old Lazarus Chakwera of the MCP, which ruled the country from 1964 to 1994, is regarded by the supporters as a transformational leader of the party that previously was associated with atrocities committed under its founding leader, the late Hastings Kamuzu Banda. Chakwera served as the president of the Christian Church, Assemblies of God, until he resigned from the pulpit and entered politics in May 2013. He promises Malawians quality leadership.
With all of the good policies my colleagues have been describing, you still need
integrity in leadership, you still need political will to follow through with certain tough decisions. You still need courage in order for these things to happen.
Political commentators say judging from the support each of the candidates is commanding, predicting a winner this time around remains a daunting task. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
The spokesman for Nigeria's ruling party has expressed gratitude to the international community for helping the country search for the schoolgirls abducted by Islamic militants, Boko Haram, about a month ago. Abdullahi Jallo says the abduction is barbaric and sharply against Islamic law. He tells reporter Peter Clotty that the administration and the international community will look for the abducted girls and ensure the militants are punished for their crimes.
The world as a whole is helping Nigeria. The president of America offers that American government will assist Nigeria at least to show to this Boko Haram that the world is not with them, and then what they are doing, they want to turn the country, the whole world back. It's like they want to go back to the time of slavery. Well, in any case, this is barbaric. As we earlier said, the international community have come in just as they went to Mali, driving these people away.
There are concerns that the government was too slow and that the federal government has not done enough to go in search of these children. They blame the ruling party for being effective. What do you say to that?
The government, years after years, Nigerian government has not anticipated that this terrorism one day will reach us in this country. And the military in Nigeria, in fact, their weapons are not as strong as that of Boko Haram. It is just this president, Jonathan, that is now promising that he's going to achieve the military. Not that the government is weak. No, the government has made adequate arrangement in sending the army. But the weapons with the terrorists are stronger.
So what is going to be done next? Now that the international community is bringing its support to the Nigerian government to help rescue these children, what is the government doing as we speak now in that effort?
The government, I believe, they should have sit down with the international committee to draw a timetable. And then, you know, the international committee have a tracking system and so many devices, because they have traced these people from nook and corners. And if they can trace Usama, I'm sure they will trace Shekau. And then he knows that, yes, if the international committee are around, that is the end of their lives. We thank the international committee for their efforts. And then I am sure within no time, God's willing, these people will be arrested and they will be brought to book for genocide.
The spokesman for Nigeria's ruling party, Abdullahi Jallo, he spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from Abuja.
Meanwhile, the 2014 farming season is proceeding against a backdrop of swelling despair for Cameroon's coffee sector. Harvests of the once booming cash crop in the Central African nation have hit an all-time low, slumping more than 50% from the previous year. Growers, dealers, experts and farm organizations are all united in blaming what they say are faulty government policies dating back to the early 1990s. They are calling for renewed subsidies for farmers, and from Douala, Ntarike Divine Jr. reports.
Until the 1990s, coffee growers were among Cameroon's wealthiest farmers. Today's figures tell a different story. Statistics from the Interprofessional Cocoa and Coffee Council reveal that yields from the 2012-2013 season stood at just over 16,000 tons, down from above 38,000. Omega Tien Maledi is executive secretary of the council.
En termes de chiffres, le café se porte mal, se porte même très mal.
Our coffee is currently in very bad shape. That's the lowest figure we have known since Cameroon started growing coffee in 1957. And yet, we have known prosperous years. In 1990, we exported 156,000 tons. That was our best year. Back then, the vastly fertile country was ranked as the world's 12th largest coffee grower. Today, it has dropped nearly 20 points, and experts fear yields could slump even further over the coming years. Ngewu Thomas is a farmer and exporter in Kong Samba, a colonial town in the littoral region once nicknamed the coffee capital of Cameroon. He says the poor yields last year could not be averted.
Beaucoup de café a été abandonné dans les plantations.
A lot of coffee was abandoned on the farms because access roads were not maintained. Elsewhere, soils are sufficiently old, and the big farmers in the years gone by are all aging out or are dead, and their children are leasing out the farms to banana producers and heading off to the cities.
Les planteurs sont morts. Les enfants ne sont pas davantage.
Experts name other factors for the decline. Climate change has brought increasingly longer rainy seasons, which have led to the shedding of leaves before pollination. Inputs like fertilizers and pesticides are more costly, and there is a lack of mechanization and of large-scale farming. The government is also allocating less technical support and grants for coffee. The decline began with the global economic crisis of the mid-1980s, which provoked sharp drops in world coffee prices. Across the major growing hubs in the western, coastal, and southeastern parts of Cameroon, demoralized farmers even uprooted coffee plants for quick maturing crops like beans and corn, which are more readily marketable locally. Officials say rather than step up incentives to empower coffee growers to weather the economic slowdown, the government blundered by freezing subsidies and liberalizing the sector. Those policies are blamed for the collapse of cooperatives. Patrice Mandeng Ambassa is a one-time trade and industry minister and current president of the Finance Commission at the National Assembly.
Je suis malheureusement le dernier ministre à avoir eu à fixer les prix.
Unfortunately, I was the last minister to have fixed prices for cocoa and coffee back then. After that, total liberalization of the sector followed, with the consequences being that the maintenance of basic infrastructure like roads stopped. The state stopped providing subventions. So farmers suddenly found themselves with financial burdens they had not planned for. The Interprofessional Council says while the problems blighting the sector have been sufficiently diagnosed, the government needs the political will to relaunch production. The government appears to be responding positively. There are ongoing negotiations for Brazilian experts to train Cameroonian farmers on best practices, as well as with the International Coffee Organization to help set up training programs and transfer technology to local farmers. In the meantime, the council says over the next 5 years, it is disbursing about $1.5 million, about 750 million francs CFA, for assorted assistance and support programs to halt the plummeting harvest. Elsewhere, farmers are saluting a decision by the European Union to grant the country $30 million for the revival of Robusta coffee production through the restoration of abandoned plantations and cooperatives, as well as the improvement of product quality and marketing. For VOA News, I'm Tarike Devine Jr. in Douala, Cameroon.
Sierra Leone is embarking on the re-registration of all companies nationwide. The Corporate Affairs Commission has been tasked with this responsibility that was once carried out by the country's Registrar General's Office. Michaela McKay is the CEO of the commission. I reached her in Freetown by phone for more on this venture.
One of the requirements of the legislation was at the commencement of the act and the functioning of the commission, all companies had to be re-registered and by way of application.
What are the compliance requirements of a company in Sierra Leone?
Essentially, is staying standing, and basically you would have your memorandum and articles of association submitted, inclusive of your declarations, that is for the shareholders of the company, for persons that have to be directors of the company. Of course, the company name and the place of doing business is going to be very important, and the objective for which the company is going to be set up. So in that respect, the standards remain the same. But all we're going to be doing under this act is basically registering all companies. And it's going to be a very important exercise, because at a recent administrative sorting exercise that we carried out by the commission, we realized that quite a number of companies on the register are actually defunct because they did not exit properly the way they do business in Sierra Leone. They still remained on the register. And the re-registration exercise is going to give us an opportunity to sort out the company's register and start up on a very clean slate.
Does this exercise encompass small businesses as well, like a sole proprietor?
Well, you know, it's an important question you just asked, because under the Companies Act of 2009, all Sierra Leonean businesses and even foreign companies that want to come to Sierra Leone to register to do a business now have the opportunity to register a one-man company, which never used to be the case under the old Companies Act, which was part of our 1960 laws. So what we actually think we're going to be seeing is a sudden increase in the number of companies registered, because definitely small enterprises or medium enterprises now have the opportunity to enjoy the benefits from having the legal status of a company.
Has there been an upsurge in illegal businesses, hence the need to regulate them?
Well, I wouldn't really say there has been an upsurge, because we did have the Office of the Registrar General that has the mandate to register companies and register businesses generally. So, in fact, what we have seen is an increase in the number of businesses being registered. But because of the Companies Act of 2009, we now have a situation where we have to specialize in dealing with companies, and sole proprietorship and partnership will still continue to register under the Office of the Administrator and Registrar General.
This seems like a huge venture. Is there a time frame within which all companies should have been registered?
We haven't really set a time frame, because, of course, it's very clear there's going to be a lot of need for sensitization, even on the mere existence of the Companies Act. So what we have done quite recently is embark on a massive radio program, sensitization, where we have actually broken down the Companies Act into different topics, so that people will be fully aware of the requirements of the Companies Act. And we have provided basic information from the different types of companies that you could actually set up, the processes to go about setting up this company, the responsibilities, and in particular the duties that are required of directors in terms of compliance, and also to keep the public informed of the consequences where there are breaches for non-compliance. Over the next 2, possibly 3 months, we actually plan on doing nationwide programs of sensitization, either through the radio or even town hall meetings, so we get down to the provincial level for full information dissemination. And then the public will be informed in the manner in which these applications are to be submitted. Because we do have quite a number of companies registered, so definitely we wouldn't be able to execute all the re-registrations in one day. So we're estimating between 6 to 8 months we will be able to complete the re-registration of the existing companies, and simultaneously we would be incorporating new companies where the need arises.
Michaela McKay is the CEO of Sierra Leone's Corporate Affairs Commission.
Society often brands people who follow paganism as their religion as deviants or even satanists. But in South Africa, several thriving pagan covens have been established. Pagan workshop worship many gods of ancient times, including old Greek and Egyptian deities. They also venerate nature, revere the earth, and pray for sun and moon goddesses. In this second part of our series on alternative beliefs, Darren Taylor takes us into an Esbat, a pagan full moon ritual.
The pagan warden, a young man in a hooded cloak, beats a drum to consecrate the pagan sacred circle to drive away evil. The pagans are dressed in long black, blue, brown, and green robes. Some shake rattles as they march slowly to a muddy, tree-filled backyard in suburban Johannesburg. A senior pagan then challenges each person who wishes to enter the large circle of wooden poles.
Who enters the sacred space?
It is I, Aisha Lorien. I come in perfect love and perfect trust.
Let it be.
May the circle begin, and I do my part.
Each pagan has a name taken from olden times.
Who enters the sacred space?
It is I, Sverhaltria.
They believe they're reincarnations of people such as the Vikings of Scandinavia, who lived around 800 AD.
Who enters the sacred space?
It is I, Ilvalon Kestavada Ankesenpa Anpu.
And how do you enter?
With the light of the full moon in my heart.
Welcome, daughter of Anpu.
Pagans worship nature by honoring a variety of ancient gods. One of them is Herne, a Greek stag god of strength with antlers. Another is the goddess Demeter, who looks after the land and provides crops. Pagans also consider her a goddess of fertility.
Yod-Heh Vav-Heh.
Adonai.
Ehe-Yeh. Agla.
They honor their archangels.
O Archangel Michael, you of the flaming sword, I call to thee. I call to you for your protection this night. Cast your wings over us. Look after us on this Esbat night.
So mote it be.
So mote it be.
And so it starts.
Another senior pagan is cloaked in a snow-white tunic rimmed with royal blue and gold fabric. He holds a wooden staff in the form of a patterned spiraling cobra. He's the pagan's spiritual connection to the gods of ancient Egypt.
Dar peshet nehes nehes tehuti. Dar peshet. Yitas namat hadeh.
They then call upon their goddess of the full moon, Selene, who they revere for her nurturing and mothering nature.
Be with us and fill our hearts with your beauty, your love, your caress for life. Bring all of our will to fruition, that we may reap the benefits of what we have sown into this earth before us.
Long golden hair streams down the pagan high priestess's dark brown cloak. A silver five-pointed star hangs around her neck. She holds a dagger high in the moonlight.
We reach for the stars and call down the moon. I bow before the moon. I bow before the moon.
The high priestess asks Selene to bless the gathering.
Othwas Bethu doth deldiende. Anal natrach. Othwas Bethu doth.
The high priest tells the pagans to make music in honor of Selene.
Let us swirl your light amongst us.
They worship the natural elements of water, air, and fire.
Hail, Lord Jinn! I call to thee, my lord. Come into the circle tonight. Bring your fiery creatures with you. Come, salamanders. Salamanders of fire. Play with us in the circle. Bring your passion. Fire on this Esbat night. Fire burning, burning bright. Come to me. So mote it be.
So mote it be.
The full moon Esbat ends with a traditional pagan parting.
Merry we meet,
and merry we part, and merry we meet again. Blessed be,
and happiness throughout the whole world.
So might it be.
Pagans say they're a breed apart because they're seekers, using a variety of different paths to live meaningful lives, and always having love and respect for all their fellow human beings as they strive for happiness. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And coming up, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, music from African Collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
But let's kick off with Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at EME. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, May 11th. We have plenty of 2014 FIFA World Cup news today. But first, let's head to the Czech Republic, where the Prague Marathon was celebrating its 20th anniversary on Sunday. A host of talented runners from East Africa were on the start line, intent on victory. Andy Edwards reports from Prague.
What a difference 12 months can make. Last year, Patrick Terreira had visa problems and had to make a late arrival in Prague from Kenya, losing a night's sleep. He showed what a strong man he is, finishing third and promised he would return the following year and win the title. He was as good as his word. No travel problems this time, and Terreira produced a confident display, beating the challenge of compatriot Evans Chebet by 10 seconds to set a personal best. Zimbabwe's Cuthbert Nyasango broke the national record for third place, a mark which had stood for 16 years. The women's race reflected the dominance of Ethiopia. The Sirahiwot Dado won by almost 4 minutes from Fantu Eticha and Ashete Bekere in third place. It was a cool day in Prague as the race began from one of its many landmarks, the Old Town Square. On past performances, Moses Mossop was highly rated, but the second fastest marathon runner of all time from Kenya was returning after a lengthy injury and not as his best. He finished outside 2 hours 20. Instead, Patrick Terreira demonstrated his confidence, always in the lead group, which went through halfway in 63 minutes 34. That group of 10 was split asunder as Terreira and fellow Kenyan Evans Chebet went clear from 30 kilometres. Soon after, one of their rivals and a winner here 2 years ago, Deresa Chimsa of Ethiopia, dropped out with a leg injury. Soon after 35 kilometres, Terreira surged to move clear. Chebet, in only his second marathon, could not close the gap, but held the margin to 10 seconds at the finish. Patrick Terreira won €15,000 in prize money with his 2 hours, 8 minutes and 7 seconds, a personal best by 45 seconds. Evans Chebet also broke 2:09 for his fastest marathon, while Cuthbert Nyasango was delighted to break the Zimbabwean record with 2 hours, 9 minutes, 52. Terreira was confident beforehand and thinks he can run even faster. Cuthbert Nyasango was also delighted, having broken the national record of a runner he greatly admired, Tendai Chimusasa. The women's race was clear-cut. Firihiwot Dado, having had a trial run in Prague last month to finish ninth in the half marathon, dominated events to win in 2:23:34. And that was almost 4 minutes ahead of Fantu Eticha, with Ashete Bekere a further half a minute behind. Testimony to the superiority of the Ethiopian women on this occasion. That's the news from Prague, Segun. Now back to you in Lagos.
Many thanks for that report, Andy. From Prague, we head to Baghdad. News from the Iraqi capital says World Football's governing body, FIFA, has threatened to suspend the country over persistent delays to elections for its football federation's leadership. A letter conveying the warning says if Baghdad does not hold elections as planned at the end of the month, FIFA may decide to impose a suspension. The Iraqi Football Association had originally planned to hold elections for its board, as well as for a new president and vice president in January. But these were delayed until April 20th, and then again until May 31st. In July 2013, FIFA barred Iraq from hosting international friendlies due to a surge in violence. Now to our weekly World Cup tidbits. It is now 31 days to the kickoff of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, and the countdown continues.
Put your flags up in the sky,
That's the official song of the 2014 FIFA World Cup, entitled We Are One. Well, with the World Cup drawing closer by the day, host Brazil on Saturday began deploying some 30,000 troops to secure its borders as it prepares to host the world. The operation involving the Army, Navy, and the Air Force will extend over the near 17,000-kilometer frontier, separating the South American giant from its ten neighbors. The internationally coordinated effort is part of a strategic border security plan announced by President Dilma Rousseff in June 2011. A similar security operation took place ahead of last year's Confederations Cup, widely regarded as a test run for the World Cup extravaganza that will see football games held in 12 cities. Among other crimes, the operation will target drug and arms trafficking, as well as illegal immigration. It will also provide medical care for needy communities. Brazil shares borders with Argentina, Bolivia, Colombia, Guyana, Paraguay, Peru, Suriname, Uruguay, Venezuela, and French Guyana. The FIFA World Cup runs from June 12th to July 13th. Brazil expects to welcome more than 600,000 foreign tourists for the massive event. Now, as the World Cup countdown continues to tick, many of the 32 participating nations have started naming their provisional squads. Let's remind our listeners that the FIFA deadline for all the teams to unveil their final squads is June 2nd. Among the teams that have named their provisional squads is Nigeria, one of the five African teams heading to Brazil. This past week, African champion Nigeria announced a team of 30 players for the global tournament. The list has generated much debate in the soccer-loving nation. Kunle Solaja is the general editor of sports for the Lagos-based The Sun newspaper. I asked Kunle if there were surprises in the provisional list. Here is his damning verdict.
Yes, there are surprises. For instance, nobody would have expected a goalkeeper like Chigozie Agbim to be in that team. He was the first choice keeper when Nigeria featured in the African Nations Championship early this year, and everybody knew how much rusty he was. This was a goalkeeper who throughout the season only played 3 matches for his club. So if he was not considered good enough to be the first choice goalkeeper in his club, I wonder what would have made him to be the first choice goalkeeper for Nigerian team, the Nigerian home-based players team featuring in African Nations Championship. And his performance at that championship still leaves more to be desired, and everybody knows that he should not have been in the World Cup team. And to make, even if he comes in the World Cup as number 3 choice, he's still a very bad omen for Nigeria. In the sense that if you remember what happened to Argentina at Italia 90, as at that time, the FIFA will always require that a player will be on standby, but the player will not fly in with the team. The player will be at home. So when, in case of any unforeseen injury, that player can then be ferried to the World Cup venue, like it happened to Argentina, Goicoechea. So, and to even safeguard that was why FIFA now allowed 3 goalkeepers to be in a team. And in the event that there is an injury to the first choice keeper, that third choice keeper became the substitute goalkeeper. So, and with the limited number of matches you have to play, and playing at a stage like the World Cup, you need to be there with your very best. So if our very best is not even the best for his own club, then we wonder. And apart from that, the man has lost esteem.
You talked about omen, the inclusion of Agbim being a bad omen for the team. What about the exclusion of Ike Uche, who is highly regarded as one of the best forwards in the Super Eagles at the moment?
Yeah, that of Ike Uche, I would say it's a surprise, and at the same time, I would say it's not a surprise. I was talking with Clemens Westerhoff, the coach that actually took Nigeria to the first World Cup, and which everybody claimed to be the best performance of Nigeria up to date. So I asked him about the exclusion of a player like Ike Uche, and his answer was direct. He said, Keshi is the boss. The boss decides who he takes to the World Cup, and it is not just the form of that player that he looks at, he also looks at the attitude. And that prompted me to go and find out what was actually the matter between Ike Uche and Stephen Keshi. We all know that last year, during the African Nations Cup, Ike Uche was supposed to be our hit man, but unfortunately, he was off form. And he last played for Nigeria in the final of the African Nations Cup against Burkina Faso, in which he was substituted because he didn't perform well. But later we gathered that he actually told some National Sports Commission top officials that Keshi should be sacked as a coach, that Keshi was not good. And I think so this thing now is more than an off-the-field incident. So, and Keshi is now saying that if a player believes that he is not good enough to coach him, then that player is not also good enough to be in his team. So, based on that, I think the two of them just cannot gel.
That was Kunle Solaja, General Editor, Sports, at the Lagos-based private newspaper, The Sun. He was commenting on Nigeria's 30-man provisional list for the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. We'll hear more from Kunle on this show next Sunday. In a related development, it is no longer news that Ike Uche, who plays for Villarreal in the Spanish League, was left out of Nigeria's provisional squad to the FIFA World Cup. What is news, however, is that Uche has continued to score for his club. On Saturday, he scored again as Villarreal defeated Rayo Vallecano 4-0. Saturday's goal was Uche's 13th league goal of the season. Though he was left out of Nigeria's 2014 World Cup squad, Uche will, however, be pleased with his efforts, which also means that he has scored more goals than any other African player in La Liga this season. The player has said he bears no grudge against Nigeria's head coach Stephen Keshi for leaving him out of his squad. Meanwhile, another World Cup-bound African team, Ghana, is set to announce its World Cup squad on Monday. Coach Kwesi Appiah will release his list at 12:30 p.m. local time and brief the media about Ghana's preparations for next month's tournament. Ahead of the unveiling of the Black Stars who will be flying to Brazil, a prophet in Ghana has warned that the country will suffer 3 humiliating defeats in the group stage unless he's paid $60,000 for the spiritual services he provided for the team in the past. According to the online GhanaSoccerNet.com, Prophet Ezekiel claims he offered his spiritual services to help the Black Stars qualify for the World Cup and has not been paid the $60,000 promised him for the work done. It is not clear who contracted him for his spiritual services, but he claims the Ghana Football Association has been warned over the impending World Cup disaster. Ghana is in a tough first-round group that includes Germany, Portugal, and the United States. Talking about the United States, the country's national football team and its Belgian counterpart will play a friendly on the opening day of the FIFA World Cup to complete their preparations. The behind-closed-doors match was announced on Friday by FIFA, which confirmed that the two national sides will meet in Sao Paulo on June 12th. With the two teams facing 3 warm-up matches before they arrive in Brazil, the friendly is expected to help the players acclimatize to the conditions they will face when their tournament begins. Belgium has already agreed to friendlies with Luxembourg, Sweden, and Tunisia before it begins its Group H campaign against Algeria in Belo Horizonte. Meanwhile, the U.S. will face Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Nigeria before traveling to Natal to face Ghana in Group G. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at Africa Sports right here on Nightline Africa.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and time for music from the continent. Enjoy!
Les rise up the Martians.
Ningependa nikuone nikupe yote vyangu nikupe chochote unachotaka chochote upate lakini sina namna ya kukupata ungekuwa nafasi unaishi ningekuwa mbali bibi ningekuja nikuone wewe ungekuwa na nambari ya simu Facebook au Twitter lakini hata sura ulificha nimesubiri sana lini tutaona na 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 I don't know what to do I'm waiting for you Rafiki yangu nimempa sasa tuzo ana asili zangu nyingi sogopi mateso au wameshaone tishi na mawazo ninae mlinzi wangu sasa mimi sitaki fujo nikiwa na yeye siogopi vya devil ademan ongeza besi na treble nimtaje kama ninae matangazo ungekuwa nafasi unaishi atingekuwa mbali bibi ningekuja nikuone wewe ungekuwa na nambari ya simu Facebook au Twitter lakini hata sura ulificha Nimesubiri sana lini tutaonana I don't know what to do I'm waiting for you Nimesubiri sana lini tutaonana Rafiki wa kweli rafiki mileli kweli Kamili anaomba tuponge Mungu Baba wilonge Gospel time now Oh Lord Joni kupe chochote nataka Hatujakutana mimi nakufuata Joni kukaribishe kwangu Joni kupikie chakula tamu Naomba nikuonyeshe na watoto wangu Joni kuonyeshe baba mama wangu Nikuonyeshe marafiki zangu Nami na moyo wangu nafasi unaishi atingekuwa mbali bibi ningekuja nikuone wewe ungekuwa na nambari ya simu Facebook au Twitter lakini hata sura ulificha nimesubiri sana lini tutaonana I don't know what to do I'm waiting for you nimesubiri sana lini tutaonana rafiki wa kweli rafiki
Chibonge by Chameleon, and that was our Sunday music spot from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now, let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Good evening, Africa. 20 years after South Africa achieved majority rule, and for the first time since Nelson Mandela's died last December, 25 million registered voters, almost half the population of the country, went to the polls last week to elect 400 members of parliament that will act as an electoral college to elect the president of this country. Last week's election also elected members of the provincial councils. There was consensus that the conduct of the elections was peaceful, free, fair, transparent, and credible. There were no serious complaints of foul play. Most impressive was the turnout of 73%. It is significant to observe that once again, a pattern of turnout in developing and emerging nations surpass those of many established democratic states. In the United States, for example, turnout in presidential elections seldom exceed 55%. In South Africa, there was no attempt to suppress votes by the enactment of so-called voter identification laws, which distort fundamental principles of democracy. When the results were announced by the South African Independent Electoral Commission, the ruling party, the African National Congress, ANC, won a comfortable victory, even though a number of commentators had suggested that the party would lose much ground owing to allegations of corruptions and failure to deliver on its promises to the people. However, as in the elections in 2009, the ANC lost some percentages from 65.9% the last time to 62% now. Accordingly, the ANC fell short of a two-third majority. All the same, the ANC victory was testimony that despite its difficulties, the people of South Africa have not forgotten its role in the long and bitter struggle against apartheid. There were some surprises in the elections. The major opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, led by the feisty Ellen Zille, made significant gains. It increased its popular vote from 17% in 2009 to 22% this year. The DA has been plagued by the perception that it is a white party, but it broke new grounds by increasing its popular vote among the black population, particularly in the province of Gauteng near Johannesburg, where it attained 33% of the votes to the ANC 53%. The DA also retained control of its stronghold in the Western Cape, with Cape Town as its capital. Another election surprise was the credible performance of South Africa's newest party. The Economic Freedom Fighters is the party formed by Julius Malema, who was youth leader of the ANC and became a thorn in the side of the leadership of the ANC. He was eventually expelled from the party and charged with corruption. The party was able to attain 6% of the popular vote and will have 23 members in the new parliament. It is expected that the new party will cause lots of problems for the ANC. The so-called born free, that is those who were born after 1994, did not vote in large number as had been expected. Julius Malema was hoping to get much votes from them. However, the fate of Malema is uncertain because he has to answer charges before the court. Even though he is faced with allegations of corruption regarding improvement in his private property, and it is certain that Jacob Zuma will will be elected to a second five-year term when Parliament convenes to elect the president. But there is also a growing consensus that the ANC leadership would have to reflect considerably to determine why it is losing support among the people of South Africa. I thank you.
That was Dr. Jonah with that commentary, One Man's Point of View.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Have a happy Mother's Day. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And hope you'll join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Most recently, he has claimed credit for the kidnapping of more than 200 young girls from a school in Chibok and is threatening to sell them. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is also known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Skikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shekau. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.